I hope this is recording. I apologize. I heard someone grumbling that there was no food, and I thought that was pretty funny because I remember my days in residency, and food was always the main draw. But being from the New York City Department of Health, you probably would not want what we brought. You know, what we bring would be trans fat free and salt free and basically disgusting. So I did not bring food. I apologize. But I am here to bring you some information. My name is Sakai Chidea. I am the Director of Public Health Policy and Programming in the Prevention Program at the New York City Department of Health. And I work with a lot of the folks who are involved in setting policy and doing testing and condom distribution around the city, creating campaigns and interventions that you may have seen, especially being here in the Bronx, you know, the big Bronx-wide, the Bronx Knows campaign. So I wanted to talk with you a little bit about how to improve HIV testing and prevention from your standpoint. This is just a brief overview. We may not get to everything, and that's okay. I'm going to leave the slides here so you all can, you know, look at them if you want. But just a few slides first on epidemiology, especially here in New York City, which is the epicenter of the national HIV epidemic. A little bit of information about HIV testing, with a particular focus on opt-out testing, which you may have heard about, because it's a big point of contention between public health practitioners and advocacy groups. Then talking about how you can assess and reduce the risk of HIV among your patients, and then how to test patients and what to do if one of your patients comes back positive. So just briefly, the HIV epidemic today, nationally, an estimated 1.1 million people are infected with HIV or have AIDS, so just infected with HIV regardless of their clinical status. That is an estimate. It's based on some complicated models and based on surveillance done actively in 34 states and Washington, D.C., but most people think it's pretty accurate. Some people actually think it's an underestimate. They think it's an underestimate because you may have heard about this. Last year, the CDC revised their estimated number of new infections from what used to be about 45,000 to now 56,000 per year based on improved surveillance. And so people are saying, well, my gosh, you know, we're still not getting actual data from all of the states. Probably the numbers are even higher. But basically there was, you know, what was it about? Think about 20% increase in the number of estimated infections every year. So it's huge. And only 44,000 of the people who are believed to be infected every year are diagnosed, which means that one in five people are walking around not knowing their status, which can be particularly dangerous, and I'll talk about why that is. In New York City, total number of HIV infected is estimated to be about 102,000, which is 1.3% of the population. And it's over 10% of the whole national burden, even though we don't have 10% of the nation's population. So as you can see, there's a disproportionately large number of people who are infected here in New York City. I should mention that the WHO definition of a generalized epidemic is 1% of a population. So basically, we have a generalized epidemic of HIV in New York City. It's pretty serious. There are about 3,800 new diagnoses every year and 2,000 deaths, or five people every day. Now, who is being diagnosed in New York City? Probably a lot of people who look like your patients. But looking at the surveillance data, it's predominantly Black and Latino people. I should mention, however, that Blacks nationwide have a higher rate of HIV testing, so more of them are being diagnosed because more of them are getting tested. So a lot of people think that the numbers for whites, Latinos, and Asians are probably actually higher than they are because those people are not getting tested nearly as much. In New York City, 73% of cases are men, and that's a typical pattern in the United States. Overseas, it's actually more women than men, but here in the United States, it's more men than women, and predominantly men who have sex with men. Were diagnosed are between the ages of 13 and 29, 27% are women, and 17%, or 1 in 6, are over the age of 50. So basically everyone is getting diagnosed. Everyone is at risk. And this just shows in a graphic manner the trends in diagnoses in New York City. And you know, things have basically, if you take all of the age groups together, the trend is downward number. And that's mainly because the 30 to 39-year-olds, which is a large chunk of New York City, and also a large chunk of the diagnoses, those numbers are going down. Our messages are working for those people. But you'll notice that younger folks, their numbers are going up, and then everyone else is basically staying flat, you know, including possibly a little bit of an increase in older people. So we're not really winning the battle against HIV, unfortunately. I think, you know, we need to figure out different ways to reach people, and we need to be more vigilant. And that's what I'm going to talk about, how to be more vigilant with your patients. And then just looking by neighborhood, the dark numbers means the highest proportion or numbers of diagnoses. And next slide. And you'll see that you guys are basically a catchment area for pretty high concentration of diagnoses. This is actually the color, so you're not this one, you're this one. You're the second highest. And you're probably also seeing patients from these areas. So what guides our ability to test patients? National recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control. The latest ones came out in 2001, and basically they recommend that providers offer testing at all healthcare settings. Initially, they said just do it in urgent care settings and emergency departments where people are looking really sick. They revised that because they realized that they're missing a lot of people. So now it's everybody, primary care, emergency room, gynecology, pediatrics even sometimes, you know, for adolescents. They also recommend notifying patients that testing will be done unless they specifically say they don't want it. And this is called the opt-out model. So patients will be tested unless they opt out. And I'm going to focus on this because I think it's really important in a minute. They also, of course, you know, still want people to consent in writing, but they want this consent to be included in the general medical consent. So you don't have to keep giving people a separate piece of paper and going over, like, you know, this is a test for HIV, blah, 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 which takes oftentimes, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. They want pre-test counseling to be streamlined. It doesn't have to be face-to-face. You can do it by video. You can give a person a pamphlet. And post-test counseling would be optional for negatives. Of course, it wouldn't be optional for positives. And high-risk people should be tested more frequently. New York State agrees with most of the CDC's recommendations, but it has one big difference, and that is the opt-out model. The advocacy groups, and I'm not trying to blame the advocacy groups, but there, let me just put it this way, the political situation in New York is very charged around HIV because it was the epicenter and it remains the epicenter of the epidemic. It's where Stonewall happened. It's where, you know, a lot of things really blossomed here in San Francisco. And so there are very strong voices in New York that do not want an opt-out model because they think people are going to be unprepared when they receive a diagnosis. And I think that their reasoning is well-intended, well-intentioned, but I think that the byproduct of that is that a lot of people are not going to get tested, and they're going to walk around with HIV until they get really sick. So until further notice, you know, New York State does not have opt-out testing, which means you have to go through the whole separate written consent, which can be problematic. These are some of the state forms. I don't know if any of you have seen them. Has anyone here done consent for an HIV test on a patient? Yeah. So these probably look familiar. How does it work here, actually? Do you do it, or do you give it to the nurse?
Form that is on the internet, which is one page.
Yeah, it's a one page.
Okay. And do you actually go through it, or do you give it to a nurse or, you know, a medical assistant to go through it? You're laughing. Why?
No,
we go through it. Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes we're just giving it.
Yeah.
Give it to the patient to read.
Yeah. No, that's appropriate.
Sometimes we have the HIV counselors who come and do it.
Excellent. When you do it, how long does it usually take you to consent and kind of explain it to someone? Just in general.
Five to 10 minutes.
5 to 10 minutes? Okay. All right. So this is just Form A, which gives information. Part B is the actual part where they sign. You can also print out materials on the internet, and so they look a little different, but they have the same information. New York City, of course, being part of New York State, we follow state law, but we are very vocal. Our department is very vocal about wanting to change state law to follow verbatim the CDC's recommendations, especially the opt-out model. This is just a picture of some of the campaigns that we've been doing to encourage people to get testing. You probably recognize this one. It's our Bronx Nose picture, trying to encourage everyone in the Bronx to get tested. But so I want to focus a little bit more on opt-out testing. Why is opt-out testing important? Why are so many people gunning for it? 7 main reasons, which I'll go through quickly. 1, effective treatment is available. 2, late diagnoses are very common. 3, patients don't think they're at risk. They're basically oblivious. 4, many doctors don't offer it. 5, some patients think they've been tested when they really haven't. 6, behavior change happens when people know that they are HIV infected. And 7, most people want a more routinized HIV testing model. So, first reason, effective treatment is available. Most of the laws, including New York State's, were really drafted. The core parts were drafted when there was no treatment for HIV. And then there was AZT, and AZT was just the only treatment, and it was really problematic. The laws really haven't changed in New York State to reflect the fact that now HIV, if caught early, is a chronic disease. You know, there are lots of different treatments for it, and the life expectancy of someone who's diagnosed young, before they are, you know, in a really bad state, is essentially the normal life expectancy of someone who does not have HIV. Second reason, it's really important, is that late diagnoses happen. Unfortunately, they happen too often. And by late diagnosis, I mean someone who is either diagnosed at the same time as presenting with AIDS, or if they develop AIDS within 3 years of their initial diagnoses. And unfortunately, in the United States, nearly half of the new diagnoses are late diagnoses. These are people who have already had HIV in their system probably for 5, maybe 10 years and have been spreading it during that time. New York City, we're a little bit lower than the national average, but we still have about 25% of all diagnoses having concurrent AIDS and being very sick. And late diagnoses are a problem because that means a person is walking around having sex, injecting drugs, donating blood, you know, whatever, all of that time unaware of their status. It also means that once they are diagnosed, they may be so far along that you can't save them, which means a lot of healthcare costs and also higher mortality. Not going to go over this, really. I mean, it's no surprise that you're going to find more people with late diagnoses among people who are presenting with symptoms. What I think is important, though, is here, looking at the routine checkup, very few people with late diagnoses, and even, you know, few people with early diagnoses are caught through routine checkups because doctors just aren't asking. It's not part of the standard procedure, and that's what we're trying to change. Number 3, patients don't think they're at risk. Patients are basically oblivious. I mean, they're human beings, and so they don't want to think the worst. But Kaiser Foundation poll, which is a nationally representative poll, and they do it every 2 or 3 years. The last one showed that 69% of people thought that they were not at risk. They were asked, why haven't you gotten tested? And they're like, oh, I'm not at risk. And this is nationally representative. So it probably included a lot of people who were at risk. And then there was another big survey, not done by the Kaiser Foundation, but another big survey of GYN patients, which showed that only 2% considered themselves to be at risk, even though nearly half reported having unprotected sex, you know, with more than one partner. So why? And I think it's just that there's so many misconceptions still around HIV. There's a lot of stigma. People think it's a gay disease. It's not. They think it's only because of drugs. It's not. They think if they just sleep with one person, they're fine, but they don't ask their partner if they're sleeping with one person? Are they, you know, are they monogamous too? A lot of older people say, you know, it's a young person's disease. I don't need to get tested. People say, I feel fine. You know, I can't have HIV. I'm healthy. So there are issues that can probably only be addressed and kind of eliminated by more testing and making testing routines, so it doesn't matter if you have any of this or not. You just get tested. So here's a Kaiser Foundation poll. Shows 69% of people who didn't get tested saying that they didn't get tested because they weren't at risk. But I think it's really important to note that the second leading reason was because the doctor never recommended it. Can you go next? So why are doctors offering testing? They don't have the time. You mentioned that, well, I think you two mentioned that, took 5 to 10 minutes. And if you're seeing a patient in an outpatient setting, 5 to 10 minutes is your entire slot. And maybe actually more than your entire slot if you're seeing people every 7 minutes. And that's unreasonable. With a more streamlined opt-out approach, it wouldn't take 5 to 10 minutes, because once a person signed the general consent, you could potentially just test them. Then there are other issues why doctors don't do it. Oh my God, here comes Miss Jones. She's so cute. She looks like my grandma. You know, there's no way in the world. If I ask her, she'll be offended. I'm too embarrassed. I can't do it. You know, that kind of stuff happens. It happens to me too. And there are patients that I think about that if I had asked them, I would have been, you know, mortified. I probably would start blushing, but who knows what they were doing. So, you know, that's my bad. Then on the opposite extreme, there's countertransference, which, you know, probably has happened to all of you, where you look at your schedule and you see Mr. Jones is on the schedule and you're like, oh my God, Mr. Jones, he's here again. How can I get him out of my room as quickly as possible? You don't even want to ask him anything because you just want him to do his thing and get out. So you don't inquire about his HIV risk, and you don't offer him a test because you don't want to see him any longer. And you have to kind of overcome that. I mean, it's hard, but you have to think about the health of your patient. Patients might be offended. You can't really control that, but you can minimize it. And then your discomfort discussing it. Okay, number five reason. Some patients think they've already been tested. And this is, I think, a reflection of some of the vagueness and the terminology that we as doctors use. Oftentimes, and I've done this myself, you say, okay, I'm going to check you for everything, let's draw some blood. But what does everything mean, unless you go through it? A person may think it means HIV. They may think it means some other obscure test. So someone actually did a survey of hospitalized patients because they get a lot of blood draws, and they found that 23% of them really assumed that they were getting an HIV test among all of those blood tests. And they hadn't. No, it's fine. These are probably the two most important slides. Number six reason, why should we move to an opt-out model? It's because those quarter of people, you know, those 24-25% of people who are walking around and don't know it, because they don't change their behavior, they're actually responsible for a good two-thirds of infections. And this was a big article that came out a couple of years ago based on surveillance data and molecular mapping and all sorts of stuff. So once people know their status, they change their behavior. And, you know, potentially this could have a big impact on the HIV epidemic if we test more people and let them know that they're HIV positive. And then most patients want HIV testing to be routine, giving patients what they want. This is Kaiser Foundation poll again, nationally representative. What comes closer? Which comes closer to your opinion? Two-thirds said they want it to be tested, you know, like any other test. They want it to be included as part of regular checks and exams. And they want you to test them. They want to be tested in the doctor's office or in the clinic. So I think we should give them what they want. And what happens if we do move to an opt-out model? This is San Francisco, which moved to an opt-out model in late 2006, and they collected data for a while, and published this in JAMA in 2007. And even though their diagnoses were already going up based on, you know, due to all of their campaigns and prevention strategies, as soon as they switched to opt-out, you know, the angle of increase, the just really, you know, it skyrocketed. So they were catching more people, getting more diagnoses because more people were getting tested. So your role as a doctor, until we do have an opt-out model, which I think may happen soon because there's a lot of discussion in Albany about it, but until we do, the things that I think I would like to stress and maybe talk a little bit about, you know, just for the next 5-10 minutes, is how you can reduce the risk and how you can help prevent HIV in your patients. The first step is assessing risks. If you don't ask about it, you'll never know it exists. So you have to do that with every patient. If you do it in a routinized way and you figure out, you know, a pattern that works for you, it might take just 2 minutes, which I think is doable. Once you find out their risk, you can counsel them on reducing it. You can offer testing, and you can facilitate prevention with those people who end up being positive. Why is assessing risk important? It's because people are not going to tell you unless you have great rapport with them, or you know they're very open to a scary degree. They're not going to walk in and tell you that they have issues. You know, you have to dig for it, and if you don't dig for it, you're not going to know. You can have some hints. You know, if someone keeps coming in for a pregnancy test or keeps coming in because they have a discharge or, you know, has a rash, you might have a sense that they're at risk, but you have to really ask them outright. And patients will tell you. They trust you, probably more than they trust anyone else. So assess, don't assume. Not to keep throwing, you know, statistics from studies out, but one study done among internal medicine doctors actually showed that 35% of them routinely asked their patients about their sexual behaviors. So it's awkward, granted, but there are ways to make it less painful for you and for the patient. Some tips: develop a routine and utilize that routine with all of your patients. You know, the routine may be a scripted couple of sentences like, "Hi, Mrs. Jones. Oh, I see you're here today for, you know, whatever. I just want to, you know, make sure everything else is okay. How is this? How is that? How's your sex life?" And just go into it from that. You know, who are you having sex with? How many times have you had sex? Do you use protection? There are ways to segue into it from almost any patient encounter. Try to avoid moral and religious judgment. I know it can be hard, but you don't want to turn someone off. And then clarify, take the time to clarify any misinformation and misperceptions that patients may have. I'm not going to read these out loud, but these are just some sample questions that a couple of people developed that I thought were good. It's not inclusive. You don't have to ask all of them. But
what is crystal meth?
What is crystal meth? It's a methamphetamine that's used. People use it as a stimulant, and it's also something that increases libido and desire to have sex. And a lot of people use it when they're having sex, and they actually use it in a way. There are ways to, you can snort it, you can inject it, and then there's a way called booty bumping, where you actually use it as a suppository, and you have sex with it in your anus, and because it's a crystal, it can cause tears and, you know, even increase your risk. So it increases libido, but also if you use it in that way, it can actually, you know, physiologically cause you to be at risk. So you know they're at risk, now what? Just remember that it's a gradual process, and that ultimately it's in their hands. You know, don't take too much upon yourself. You can't force a horse to drink the water. You know, you can lead it to it. What's that? You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. So you have to do your best to try to influence people to do the right thing, but ultimately it's their decision. But you have to try. I think it's very important to try. And there are ways that you can do that within a 10-minute appointment, or if this is an inpatient and you have longer, you can just sit at their bed and talk with them. Emphasize again that your primary concern is for their health, that you're concerned about them, and outline why you are concerned. And then, next slide, brainstorm. You know, take a couple of minutes and think about alternatives that are acceptable to the patient. You know, progressively going to a place that is safer. What if you just carry a condom in your purse all the time? Okay, I guess I could do that. Why don't you try, you know, going to Duane Reade and buying syringes instead of bumming them off of your friends? Yeah, I guess I could do that. They're pretty cheap. I could do that. So there are ways to, you know, get people to behave more safely without making them go cold turkey. And really make it interactive. Try to get them to suggest ways that could work. And then don't go it alone. You have a lot of social service support out there. Case managers, psychiatrists, rehabilitation, support groups. You can easily refer people. And oftentimes those kind of ancillary services will do wonders. Last thing, when I was practicing in San Francisco, one thing that I would do with people for pain management was kind of develop an informal contract with them, where I would just write something on a prescription pad, I would sign it, I would have them sign it, and I'd make a photocopy and put it in a chart saying, you know, I'm not going to ask for more than 10 Vicodin a month, or, you know, something like that. And it was surprising how many people actually adhered to that because I wrote it down, even though it had no legal weight. And I think there's something about putting things in writing that makes people take it more seriously. And so that's something that you could also consider. I will always carry a condom. But even if they don't want to change their behavior, you can still offer them an HIV test. So, quickly, how to offer an HIV test. Who? Everyone who's a new patient, everyone getting a physical, old, young, whatever. And then the high-risk patients that you know are high-risk because you did an assessment. How introducing the topic, providing brief pretest counseling, either a pamphlet or a video, or face-to-face if you want, answering any questions, getting the consent, and providing post-test counseling. Introducing the topic, it's kind of like assessing risk. You know, find a routine that works for you. I'd like to include an HIV test on your lab panel because I think it's important that everyone knows their status. And the key here is everyone, so they don't feel like they're being singled out. The other two bullets are also kind of stressing that it's really important. You're not being singled out because I think you're sleeping around or you're a drug addict. You know, I really want you to get the test because it's important for everyone. Obtaining consent, I think many of you have already, you know, done this, so I'm not going to really talk about it. These are just some minimum requirements. But just within a few slides, these are the last few slides, what do you do if a patient is positive? Probably most of you have encountered patients who do end up being positive. I'm not sure what the standard procedure is here. Probably you refer them immediately to someone who would start taking care of them. But say you leave residency and you're in a private practice. What would you do? First, of course, confirm it. Most people now are using the rapid test, which is nice, but it's not 100% foolproof. Neither is the Western blot, but it's closer to 100%. So you need to confirm it. And then tell the person and reassure them that they're not going to drop dead. You know, you're not going to be abandoned. It's treatable, even if you're at a bad stage. Complete the provider report form and then facilitate these things: partner notification, counseling, linkage to care, case management, pharmacotherapy. Next slide. All of these things together are called prevention with positives, or PWP. And prevention with positives is basically any activity that reduces the likelihood of HIV transmission to others from an HIV-infected person. So there are a slew of things that actually fall under this umbrella. But the main intention is to prevent those one-third of cases that we have known, that we know due to that study, come from people who are known HIV positives. And so that would translate in New York City to a decrease in the number of new cases from 3,800 to 2,500 if we were 100% successful in preventing people with known HIV from passing it on. So these are just some examples of things that would fall under the umbrella of PWP, prevention of positives. As you can see, they're all very varied. What can you do at your level as a single doctor? Again, same thing. Assess behavior. Make sure that the person is being safe. You won't know that unless you ask them what they're doing. And then again, frame it in a way where the benefit is theirs. It's not that you're concerned more with their partners, you're concerned with the patient in front of you. And then again, collaborate with social services. Refer. At the facility level, for the chief residents, maybe who have a little bit more sway about changing things at the facility level, some things that we've found to be really, really successful in improving provincial positives is making sure that your service and your clinic is culturally competent, especially in New York City where you have so many different kinds of people. Make sure materials are low literacy, put videos up for people who can't read, have translators ready, because no one is going to understand fully what you're asking of them if you're not speaking their language. Try to integrate PWP-related questions into your intake forms. Oftentimes a new patient will have to fill out a form saying they have this medical history and they have that. Add a few questions saying, what kind of contraception did you use? How many partners have you had in the past 6 months? You know, you can put some questions in that are really informative, and then it'll be in the record and you know to address it. So, just wanted to again stress, I mean, I went through a whirlwind of things. There's a lot more that I could talk about that I'm not, but I wanted to leave time for questions, and I also didn't want to put you all to sleep. So, thank you very much. Any questions? Anything that I can address? Yes?
So, with the whole opt-out issue with that perhaps being a possibility in the future, have there been issues brought up about patient privacy? Because in the past, that was a big issue regarding HIV testing.
Right.
It being a stigmatized disease.
Right.
Still that
being right. Stigma is definitely still an issue, especially in a lot of the high-risk communities, you know, Black and Latino populations. There is that concern, and that's one of the big arguing points for the advocacy groups who are fighting against it. But going to the San Francisco example, you know, where it has resulted in more tests, people have constantly been doing surveillance to see if patients have had a problem with it, whether there's been an increase in stigma, an increase in kind of psychological harm because of it, and they have not found any negative results from it. I know patients are different in San Francisco versus New York. San Francisco is not nearly as diverse or as gay friendly. But based on what we've seen from other places, it's actually not resulted in any, you know, worsening of stigma and discrimination.
How close are we in New York to
moving to that?
Yes, moving to
I
that.
Think we're really close. I think it actually may happen in the next year, probably not 2009, given the Senate. The Senate being very silly right now. But I do think it probably will happen because there are more voices who are arguing for it, and now there are some actual proposals being put out on the Senate floor to move in that direction. And I think there are actually some advocacy groups that are now moving towards that direction too, because they realize that this model will end up, will probably be more successful in turning the epidemic around than just the status quo. So I do think things are changing. Can I ask a question? I know you said you've done consents, both of you. How many people here have offered an HIV test to a patient in the last month? Okay. Maybe about half. Not to pick on people. You! I'm going to pick on you. You didn't raise your hand. Why have you not offered an HIV test to? No, him. And you can answer too. I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but I mean, can you think back to, like, some of your last patient encounters? Has it been because you've been rushed or, you know, you didn't want to do it?
Sometimes your patient doesn't take a lot of time, to be honest, so necessary.
I think the real reason is that you have the HIV counselors, so I think that the new policy is that almost everybody will get at some point screened for HIV by the counselors, even at the ER. From the emergency department, we see most of them being screened or they refuse or something like that.
Right.
So I said that I have offered HIV testing to some of the patients, but it was really crucial
for the present illness and the diagnosis, and there was no HIV counselor available, that's when we would offer them the HIV testing ourselves.
But do the HIV counselors here approach patients even if you don't ask the counselors to approach the patient? They just automatically will...
They approach the patients from the ER.
Okay.
That's why the house staff usually don't do it.
Okay. Do you all do any outpatient clinical work? Are the HIV counselors there as well? They're not.
Haven't you seen Lakey patients calling for HIV?
Yeah.
So I think there are some kind of...
Dr. Toledo
has this project that is expanding more and more, so I think that
because
we are close to...
Because often some patients who just got tested in the outpatient clinic, they came with the medication.
We see patients in the outpatient clinic who come...
Okay.
There are vitals of HIV negative.
But if you see someone in an outpatient clinic and they're not in, they never go to the ED, you have to initiate.
Okay.
Okay.
And in that case, I think sometimes we just call up the counselors if it's like they're available. Sometimes the patient, I mean, it's a little time consuming to be honest.
And it's difficult, it's a project, so if we test them, something might actually be missed for the clinical research purposes of Dr.
Right. You're trying to say something?
Yeah, I think we have a provision in our clinic that if a patient wants to go for an HIV test, he can go directly to the HIV counselor who sits in the clinic without going through a doctor, like an official clinical visit. And if they don't know that and they actually got an appointment fixed for the same reason, like I had a clinic appointment with a patient who just came for an HIV test, once I went through the entire history physical, I came to know that he just wanted the HIV test. I didn't know that he can go directly to the counselor, so I was told and then we're done. But there's a provision that they can go directly, that's fine.
Right.
And
right.
even the regular clinic patients who have been following at our clinic for a while, if they want, they can just go to the counselor.
Right.
They even get asked many times before coming in to see you in the office, they get asked by the PCA or the nurses if they want a test. And if so, they go see the counselor.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So it's part of their kind of triage?
It will be part of the
Okay.
For everyone.
That's excellent. That would be great if it really is like on the list of things to do. Check blood pressure, check temperature, ask about HIV. Right. That's great. That's great. Any other questions? Thank you all.
Thank you.